that everybody knows, Senator Frank Shields is feeling ill, but he's attending by telephone, so he's up listening to all this, so don't tell any jokes about him. I was chastised by one of the committee members earlier for having a, quote, informational hearing, because I've bristled at having them in other committees, but I would point out that it is directly related to this Senate Bill 538 that we'll get to very quickly. And then let's go into the public hearing on Measure 37, and I'd like a discussion of the claims process and start moving forward on that. So if we could have the informational hearing on the guest ranch, and John Jennings and Jim Johnson, are you here? Yeah. And my understanding from my... Senator Westland, would you like... No, he's taking his folder. And just so for scheduling purposes, how long are we looking at? About 5 minutes?
I think we'd try to beat 5 minutes.
Okay, that'll be great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I am John Jennings, Department of Land Conservation Development. With me on my right is Jim Johnson with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. You should have before you a report entitled Guest Ranches in Eastern Oregon. This report was called for by a previous session of the Oregon Legislature in conjunction with this guest ranch idea. It's very brief. We'll go through the introduction. Is that basically the introductory discussion that came in 1997, and the idea was trying to provide an additional tool for commercial livestock operators, ranchers, to do something in addition to help them out, supplement their income, and to supplement existing opportunities for destination resort development, a broad variety of non-farm uses already authorized by the statute, and really anything else that might be able to be considered by the Goal 2 acceptance process. Moving on to the summary of the guest ranch legislation, the idea was to come up with something that was simple and could be treated as a simple conditional use in an exclusive farm use zone in Eastern Oregon that would complement existing ranches and be subservient to livestock production as the source of income on that ranch. So it would be something that they could do in addition, and that the resort component would not become the dominant feature. And to try to accomplish that, there were some limitations set on what could happen. And basically, the more land you had, the larger ranch you had, the more units you could have. You had to have at least 160 acres. You had to be an existing and continuing livestock operation. Practicing farm use, that term is defined in the statute. And then you could do certain things. You could have some overnight lodging, up to a maximum of 25 rooms, I believe. You could provide some food services for guests of the ranch, but not the public in general. And there are some other things about steering the operations away from high-value farmland or some things like that. So there's some sideboards placed in an attempt to accomplish providing a simple opportunity for existing ranchers to supplement their income. Since 1997, there have only been about 8 of these approved in the state of Oregon, all in Eastern Oregon. It was designed to be exclusive to Eastern Oregon. We have 8 guest ranches which have been approved. There have been 6 counties. St. Gillam County has had 2 approved. Baker County has also had 2 approved. Others have been approved in Lake Deschutes and Harney counties. There's no real attempt by the report to analyze the type of ranch operation, the number of cattle being run, or other aspects of the operation, but we do have an assessment of the acreages and the average acreage. Just looking at the location and the names here, my guess is that they really run the whole spectrum from, you know, a modest situation on 160 acres something a little more on a big ranching enterprise like a GI ranch, a sort of GI ranch in Eastern Oregon. That's about where we're at. I just thought in with the conclusion, which has been provided by all 3 of our agencies, being Department of Agriculture, the ELCD, and Economic and Community Development. I'll just read from it. In paragraph 2 of the conclusion, last page 7, it says, since there have only been a few approvals under this act and little experience with its implementation, the ELCD, ODA, and OECDD recommend that the legislature hear from any of the parties with respect to guest ranch legislation and, if appropriate, reauthorize its use and continue to monitor its implementation by extending the sunset clause and requiring a subsequent report to the 2009 Legislative Assembly. That's the report. Unless there's any questions,
okay.
I think I'm done.
You know, let's just go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 538, because we'll be talking about that. Did you have anything to add then? Or?
Not until testimony on the bill.
I think we'd like to come back up if there's an opportunity.
Okay, you've got more testimony on the bill. Is it, I mean, real briefly, is it your position on the bill that you, rather than just eliminating the sunset, you want to extend it?
Well, I think the position that was drawn up by the three agencies was that there's not enough understanding of how it works, and so to eliminate sunset probably be a little bit premature.
Okay. Well, let's give some of the proponents the chance then. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. If this bill or this law is allowed to sunset either now or by your proposal 2009, these eight current ranches that are there, would they become non-conforming uses and would have to be required to shut down then under the because they're no longer the authorized?
Mr. Beyer, my expectation would be no. I mean, certainly they would not be required to shut down. They've been legally established. And I don't believe that counties would be required to treat them as non-conforming uses. They've been established under existing legal provisions which authorize them.
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, and Chris, maybe chip in on this order, but I think the term that would be used would be considered a pre-existing conditional use, that which is different than a non-conforming use. So it has that lawful status as a pre-existing conditional use as opposed to non-conforming use.
Second question, Mr. Chair, and maybe you guys aren't the right people to answer the question, but if there are people who own property now and this bill is allowed to sunset and their property now would allow a guest ranch with Measure 37, if this bill is allowed to sunset, would they then have the potential to file a Measure 37 claim because they have lost use of their property?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I haven't thought about that. I'm not prepared to respond to that, and you're probably right. I'm probably not the best guy to answer that.
Yeah. Let's, if you could step back, and we'll give...
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that informational hearing. But we're in the public hearing on Senate Bill 538. And let's start with Senator Westland, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just, excuse me. If Representative Wisnett wants to come forward as well, you walked in at just the right time.
Senator, thank you.
Senator Westland.
Thank you. For the record, I am Senator Ben Westland, District 27. I am here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 538, the legislation before you that modifies the state's guest ranch statute. The bill requests three changes to existing statute. It repeals the existing sunset, increases the size of lodging facilities, and allows guests food service. But I will allow those specifics to be further explained and addressed by my friends and fellow Deschutes Countyites, Gary Blake and Linda Swearingen, that will be following me in my testimony. What I want to tell you is a few things about Deschutes County and why this bill is important. It all stems from who and what we are. We are the premier recreation area in the Pacific Northwest. Indeed, just taking into account the three old recreation areas, Black Butte, Sun River, and Eagle Crest, and not including Broken Top, Pronghorn, the Rim Rocks, and numerous single-family vacation homes, the total assessed value of just those three old sites is $1.9 billion. Contrasted with all the commercial industrial property combined assessed value at $900 million. In short, recreation are us. That's important, not just for Deschutes County, but for all of Oregon. And it's important that this market be allowed to rationally expand and meet the changing needs of an ever-evolving market. And this specific property is a perfect example of this. Originally, it was, and still remains, a working ranch with an RCI timeshare placed on top of it. Since its recent purchase by Mr. Blake and his partners, Those timeshares, I believe it was 22 in all, were actually taken off and donated to Habitat for Humanity, a very generous gesture on the part of the ranch owners. In addition, I'd like to say that I know these individuals, and I know them particularly well, seeing as how I live at the back end of the ranch. We borrow and steal equipment from each other regularly, as I'm sure Senator Beyer can appreciate from a rancher's perspective. And the quality of these individuals and the project that they're currently working on, I think, speaks volumes to the necessity of this legislation. In short, what it allows is a working ranch to remain a working ranch and meet the changing needs of a market that's critical for Oregon's success into our future. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Just a quick question. You heard a comment that the department folks recommended extending the sunset because we just don't have enough track record with it yet. There's just not enough data out there to really know how it's operating. Any comment on that?
I think that's an acceptable line of thinking at this time, but particularly as it relates to Senator Beyer's question with regard to these guys getting up, going, making the investment, and then all of a sudden, whatever the conditional grandfathering would be that should the bill pass, okay, that they allowed to be continued to operate. Under those circumstances, I don't think we have a problem with the sunset.
Okay. Representative Whitman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and other members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. Senator, I would have to disrespectfully disagree. We want this permanently removed, this sunset. We think that the track record's there, Mr. Chair, and this is a great example of mixing tourism with agriculture. And I think that the track record's there. These gentlemen are proving it's working. You have the bill before you. You know what we're asking to be allowed to do as far as the guest rooms and the food. I think, as Senator Weston said, we have a unique county that we're proud of. If I'm not mistaken, we were even featured on a TV series as far as a dude or guest ranch that featured Central Oregon. And so I think it is a new industry, and we would hope, I have some further testimony, but Senator Westland covered most of it. But it is a new industry, agritourism. And I think the bill before you gives us an opportunity to use this in a lot of parts of eastern Oregon, and I would really encourage you to pass this bill and remove the sunset permanently to allow these good people to further enjoy their fruits of their work. And it does not destroy the agriculture situation there. They're using it when times that they cannot use it for other purposes. So thank you for the opportunity to testify for people, their constituents of Senator Westland and my district. And I'm sure that this committee will make the right decision. Thank you. Any questions, committee?
Senator Reno?
Yes.
Thank you. I apologize for being late. I had constituents visiting who were here with the school rally. When you talk about agriculture in that part of the state, what are you talking about? What kind of agriculture is going on out there in conjunction with the guest ranches?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, mostly hay, but I'll defer to my senator here. He does some agriculture business out there, but we have cattle, horses, hay. You have to get up into Jefferson County to get some of the crops of carrot seed and alfalfa. We do have alfalfa in Deschutes County, too.
Senator Burdick, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, specifically as it relates to this particular specific example, it's a cattle alfalfa operation, and as I previously noted in the testimony to the committee, this specific piece of property originally was a working cattle ranch with an RCI timeshare facility on it that has since been purchased by our constituents. They very generously donated all of the RCI timeshare homes off to Habitat for Humanity and are now looking to establish guest ranch status for this particular piece of property, with the understanding that it remain exactly what it's always been, which is a cattle and alfalfa operation.
Mr. Chair, there's a big difference between, as Representative Wisnett pointed out, that between agriculture and Jefferson and Deschutes County. How many of these guest ranches are actually in Jefferson County, where I would imagine there would be more conflict with agriculture?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think zero in Jefferson County.
Senator Burdick, on page 6, there's a list that shows all 8.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. And again, I apologize for showing up late with lots of questions that have already been answered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just for Senator Burdick's information, this bill, as it is currently written, and the council can correct if I'm wrong, but it has to be a livestock operation for this bill and for this chapter of law, not a farm, not a grass seed operation or carrot seed or something like that. It has to be a livestock operation.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you.
I can certify to that, Mr. Chair. When the ranch's cows get out, they come onto my lawn. When my wife is not happy.
Thank you very much, Senator Westland.
At least you don't have to mow your lawn as often.
Well, there are other impediments.
Linda Swearingen and Gary Blake, please. And just so the audience knows, there's about 3 other witnesses on this bill, and then we'll go to the Measure 37 claims process. And he brought a map with him.
I got a map. Do you want me to bring that up?
Yeah, why don't you just bring that up quick? Good afternoon, Chair Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Linda Swearingen, and I'm here with Gary Blake and Craig Morton, owners of Deschutes River Ranch in Tumalo, Oregon. And as you might remember, last year I came up with some changes within the guest ranch statute, and we made some changes last session. In fact, what we did last session is we removed the 10-mile radius from all the towns in eastern Oregon other than Bend. And the reason why we didn't address Bend at the time is the individuals I've represented didn't really have any properties near Bend and weren't interested in it. Otherwise, we would have tackled that issue last session. And one of the things that I would like to mention is the reason why we asked to have the sunset removed was at the request of Deschutes County. We've worked very closely with Commissioner Dennis Luke and Kevin Harrison out of the Planning Department, and they've had some experience with Rock Springs Guest Ranch and some other ranch properties and felt like there was enough information to go ahead and have that removed. But, as a former county commissioner and mayor, I understand at times you want to have a sunset so you can review the law. And we don't have a problem if you amend the bill to include a sunset. If that makes everybody more comfortable, that's fine with us.
Linda, just I'm sorry to interject, but the potential concern, and I'm not even saying it's a concern that I have, is that the guest ranches could become too big and actually become the focus of the property, so it kind of blends into more of a resort and less of a farm. Is that what? And then we've taken farmland out of production. I mean, is that what people are?
Actually, I have not heard that concern, but I can see where you might draw that conclusion. Again,
well, can you articulate for me then the concern and just not letting these go?
Well, a couple things that are really important to us. First of all, we need to have the sunset either removed or extended.
Right.
And the other thing that's very important to Gary and Craig is the 10-mile radius, because they're not even allowed under the current statute to go ahead and benefit by this. And the other thing that we did is we took a look at existing guest ranches, and we took the one that the state has cited several times, and that's Rock Springs Guest Ranch. And you're going to hear from John Gill after we're done testifying, and he is also the president of the Dude Ranch Association in America and has a lot of experience with it. And so what we did is we took a look at his ranch in particular, his cattle operation, and the guest ranch part of his operation as well, and said, okay, let's look at a guest ranch that's successful, that a county has had experience with in the state, and let's model the bill after that. And so that's what we did. Now, of course, he's grandfathered in. And so what we did is we said, okay, if it's working there, maybe it'll work across eastern Oregon. The other thing is, as you can tell, we've only had 8 of these actually, since the statute was enacted, operate. And so we believe that the reason why that has been the case is there isn't enough flexibility in this. But there is a concern that, from these gentlemen's standpoint, that they have a cattle operation. I mean, that really is what they're doing, and they're going to talk a little bit about that. So maybe, Gary, you want to go ahead and talk about your background and talk about the ranch.
Chairman Ringo and committee members, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Gary Blake with Deschutes River Ranch. We are Ben Westland's next-door neighbor in Tumalo, Oregon.
Wow.
Linda's asked me to give a little bit of my background in guest ranches and in ranching. Actually, it began clear back in the 80s when I spent 3 years up in the Flathead Valley in Kalispell, Montana, consulting with the Flathead Valley Tourism Commission, helping them to design a plan to migrate from a timber and mining economy to a tourism economy. Somehow out of that three-year experience, I actually ended up buying a guest ranch and running it. Frankly, not as successfully as I would have liked, so I sold it, and it was tough being an absentee landlord and flying up to Montana all the time. We moved to Central Oregon about 10 years ago from Corvallis, and actually owned the property that Representative Wisnant talked about, which was the ranch that was the headquarters for the ABC series McKenna.
Sure.
Subsequently, Craig and I were fortunate enough to acquire Deschutes River Ranch. The ranch is a 450-acre ranch. Air miles, only 4.4 miles from Bend, but it has a rich heritage. It actually was begun in 1885 by Marshall Aubrey of the Aubrey family, if you've heard of Aubrey Butte in Bend. So it goes all the way back that many years. Our intent since acquiring the ranch has been to maintain and grow a historic ranching operation. And all of you know that's probably not that easy. It isn't that easy. Right now, we hay, we have cattle, and we have horses. And every year when we look at where we've been, we've lost money. So some of the things that we've done that are interesting and have some potential is we have spent the last year working on kind of viability and sustainability issues, and we've gotten our herd certified, and we can now have USDA certified beef, which we think has got some opportunity for us. As we looked at that, though, we said, boy, wouldn't it be nice to be a little higher on the food chain and instead of going through the middleman, actually be able to serve our own beef at the ranch, which is where the food service part came from. We, by the way, only will have the guest ranch portion on non-irrigated land. We have 200 acres of irrigated land that we intend to keep in production because that's how we have our cattle. They've got to have a place to feed, and we've got to have a place to grow hay. Some of the issues that we come across, though, really are just high cost of ranching. How do you make a living? We spent last year $17,000 on electric bills to run the pumps to irrigate the land, another $6,000 just on water bills, high labor costs, and all that. And when push comes to shove, you go, this needs to be a viable, sustainable operation. We've also spent a lot of time consulting with NRCS, soil and water people. We've worked with the Deschutes River Conservancy on water conservation members. So we are exploring every avenue we can to make sure that we are viable. And when it came to it, we said, you know, we think a guest ranch is consistent with the intent of ranching. It's not our primary focus. We believe that we can offer an experience to people where they can actually experience a working ranch and see what that's like. And a lot of people, as you know, in the city, to them, beef comes from Safeway in a plastic wrap. So, you know. So that's kind of the genesis of all of this. But just for the record, you know, as we look at it, lodging obviously is an important component of this. And guest ranches are a seasonal business. So that means you've got to have a high occupancy rate in the peak season, but then all of a sudden you get into the shoulder season and the off season, it becomes iffy.
Yeah, so we just need to wrap up in a minute and stay on
I'll
track
wrap up
here.
Then. In essence, I'd just like to say that I believe that what we've proposed is very consistent with the intent of the current law. We're only asking for the removal of a couple of points to allow us to take a run at this guest ranch. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead? Did you have?
I just quickly wanted to point out, you know, on the map and mention a couple things with regards to the distances.
Yeah.
Chairing committee, just briefly. Currently, you see Bend. Bend on the map, and the closest one, which is Rock Springs, who you'll hear from John Gill momentarily, 2.5 miles away from the urban growth boundary. That has been in operation for 35 years with none of the, you know, seemingly no conflicts with any of the economic activity of Bend itself, and actually enhancing the overall experience of the area, I think, significantly. We're then located the Deschutes River Ranch, that thing that looks like an upside down L, a reversed L. Up above there is currently 4.24 miles as the crow flies. But you can't really jump on a crow to get to Bend. You got to drive in a car, and that takes probably 10 or 15 minutes, and it's about 10 driving miles to Bend. And then you have some, you know, and then you show the others that are farther up, and it shows the distances. But these are the two represented here today. I think the point is that we fit all of the criteria and the purpose and the intent of the initial guest ranch provision, in that it's always been a ranch. It was established as a homestead of MCI, as we spoke about. It's been in production and been used as a working ranch ever since. It was then bought and converted to a timeshare. The timeshare continued to maintain the ranch primarily as an amenity to the guests there. We have already secured it in perpetuity. All of the irrigated land in perpetuity is locked up for agriculture, or if the water dries up, it will be open space. We've already done that. So now what we're trying to do is make it viable, and continue to enjoy the green, the beauty, and provide enough income to support the ranch. So it seemed to fit the criteria, and we would just like to, on a couple of points, get a little bit more leeway to make it viable.
Thank you very much.
Ringo, just a couple other things. What we did is we made some changes in the definition of lodging units, because one of the things that we found at Rock Springs is people are interested in separate units, and so that's why we clarified that. One other thing, I had an opportunity to talk with John Jennings prior to the hearing, and DLCD's concern was, you know, we don't want to have restaurants out in these rural areas. Yet we totally agree. This is not intended to have restaurants out in a rural area. But we do want the ability to do weddings, catered events, day conferences, those sorts of things. And that's what currently is happening at Rock Springs.
Okay. Thank you. Committee?
No.
Okay. If we could have our next witness, John Gill, please. We think you can handle it.
I hope so. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for having me here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
My name is John Gill, and my family owns Rock Springs Guest Ranch just outside of Bend, Oregon, that they alluded to, about 2.5 miles from the urban growth boundary. And it was started by my aunt, Donna Gill, in 1969, been in our family for 35 years. My aunt had also gone way back into the 30s and been in recreation/agritourism. Prior to this, we had a place near Sisters called Indian Ford Guest Ranch, which was 3,000 acres, which we sold a few years ago, unfortunately. Rock Springs is open year-round. We decided a few years ago that instead of just being seasonal, which is our primary summer family dude ranch thing, people come for a week at a time, like going on a cruise. It's a package product. People come from all over the world to stay there. We market stuff. We were in New York at a trade show a month ago, traveled to Japan with the state tourism division, have been many different places promoting Oregon and also our beliefs in guest ranching. So we do the summer thing, and then the rest of the year we do a lot of group business, conferences, and then occasionally when things need be, we do some banquets, some weddings and things, just to keep our staff busy, because we'd like to have a year-round staff and not have to rehire each year. Our particular ranch, in terms of zoning, we were there in 1969, and things were kind of laid right over the top of us, so we are actually a non-conforming use, which is not really where we'd like to be. I'm also the president of the Dude Ranchers Association, which was formed in 1926, and kind of the history of dude ranching or slash guest ranching. It's used somewhat interchangeably.
So we're going to need to wrap this up in a couple of minutes, but did you have questions?
Well, I just want to know why you call it a guest ranch instead of a dude ranch.
Well, I think that comes from, it's used interchangeably, but I think dude at one time had kind of a negative connotation. Now dude's kind of come back to be kind of a cool thing. So, anyhow, I don't know if I could add much more, but I do think it is a way to conserve a lot of open space, and we just bought about 400 acres around us in the last 5 years to protect that space and give people a glimpse of a different experience instead of coming to big resort Sun River kind of resort town anywhere. It's a unique experience. Take about 50 people, and we're just back visiting some of our people in New York. Stayed with them at their house there, and they've got pictures of our place all over, and it's a pretty neat experience.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, just a self-indulgent question, if I could. Who bought the Indian Ford place from you?
Well, actually, that was the Brockman family. Mm-hmm. He was a former senator here in Oregon, and they bought part of that, and then the other part of it, Indian Ford, became Indian Ford Ranch Homes, and it's been developed somewhat around the meadow there.
Oh, okay. Just curious. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's bring Jim Johnson and John Jennings, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm John Jennings, Department of Land Conservation Development. I know we're under time constraints, so I'll be very brief. Essentially, our perspective on this is that it came about in 1997. Almost every session it's been amended, and almost every time it's been amended has been for a single issue. It would be our preference, I think, that unless it can be demonstrated that the proposed adjustments do further the original notion of assisting commercial livestock operators, that we stay with what we have. And that'll conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, and we'll turn to my colleague, Jim Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I assume you mean stay with what we have and extend Sunset, or
yes,
or
Senator
remove
Brady,
the
thank
Sunset.
You.
Do you have a preference on extending or removing the Sunset?
Well, I think that as unfortunately, you missed some of the earlier discussion. It is a state agency's position that extending the Sunset to 2009 would be entirely appropriate.
Do you could you articulate the concern? I mean, I was attempting to articulate it, but I'm not sure that I did it correctly. But
well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think that you had it quite right. And again, what we have right now, or had in 1997, has had for quite some time, is the ability to site large and small destination resorts and exclusive farm use zones, and the ability to have all sorts of non-farm uses like bed and breakfasts and golf courses and private parks and dog kennels. And also there's a goal to exception the process, that if someone doesn't fit, they can come in and try to demonstrate to the local decision makers that they have a unique situation. And so we were adding something to that, something that we wanted to be a simple process, but be somewhat limiting and not overtake some of the other things, and that it would be a companion. It would be a supplement to an existing commercial ranching operation. It wouldn't be a pseudo destination resort. It would be someone that continues to practice livestock production, but is also doing something in addition to that to supplement their income.
Okay.
Chair Ringo, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We agree with DLCD's comments and we would support an extension of the Sunset. We're concerned that some of the expansions proposed in the bill, that being related to the restaurant and the lodging, we don't have enough experience with the current law to support that expansion at this time. When you look at the report conclusions that talk about little if no experience in terms of conflicts with surrounding operations, not to mention whether or not it's a conversion, and when you look at the proposed 30-year review of the planning program And then when you look at any implications with Major 37, once you make a change here, for example, you're not going to go backwards with it if there are issues related to it. We just believe that it's better to take a look at this in a bigger perspective and not make the proposed expansions here, but the sunset would be all right.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do get back to the whether or not it would be a non-conforming use. You said it would be a pre-existing conditional use, and I'm trying to find out where in a statute that would be. I mean, it seems to me that is a non-conforming use, and I'd like to know if there's some place that we've missed up here is where you would find a pre-existing conditional use.
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, I'd have to dig it out, but if I remember right, it's somewhere in ORS Chapter 215 as it relates to the responsibilities of county planning departments. And there's a provision in there that talks about, under the non-conforming use section, there's another section there that talks about pre-existing conditional uses.
Okay.
This is Chris Crane, Community Council. My quick review of the statutes, and based on what my understanding, I think it would be a non-conforming use under sub 5 of 215.130. A lawfully established use is allowed to continue, so any guest ranch established under this statute while in effect would be allowed to continue even if the statute were repealed. It would just be subject to the alteration provisions in sub 9 of that statute.
Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
We're not going to move this bill today. Frankly, I don't have a committee enough to move it. We'll definitely either extend the sunset or remove the sunset. I can give you assurance that one of those two things will happen, and we'll be talking further to figure out which is the best direction. But I appreciate your folks coming over from the Bend area, and I like to go over to that area a lot myself. But thank you very much for coming. And let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 538, and let's open the hearing on the Measure 37 claims process. Yeah, I would. And I just wanted to explain a couple things to the audience, and I've spoken to several of you directly about this, but I want our committee to start putting together the building blocks of what might be revising Measure 37 in a way to make it workable so that it local governments know what it means and so that it more closely carries out the intentions of the voters. And Chris Crane has drafted a claims process that it's not in legislative council form, but it's in a statutory form. And this is not meant to be the committee's proposed solution, but it's one way to go, and I would appreciate input from all quarters on some of these details. And in the weeks that follow, we will be taking bite-sized chunks of other parts of addressing Measure 37. I think we'll be meeting soon on the compensation mechanism, for example, and so I would just appreciate the input from anyone involved who has an interest in that. In that regard, we're going to be meeting Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. in the Senate Democratic Office Room, and Chris will be there. It's not a work session. It's just a discussion session. And so if anybody wants to be there to be part of that, that would be fine. You bring the maple bars, though. So with that, I'd like Chris just to explain what he drafted and explain some of the policy choices that he made.
Okay.
And then immediately thereafter, we'll have DLC Director Shetterly to express any comments that he may wish to give us.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. Senator Beyer, just a brief disclaimer. You know, since Measure 37 passed in November, I have gone to a countless number of CLEs and seminars and presentations, so on and so forth. In fact, I stopped going because you just started hearing the same stuff over and over again. I did query a number of people in drafting this proposal, but it's based on everything I've heard over the last few months, and I think represents, for the most part, a majority position on some of the fairly technical process issues. So, and a lot of it's just cleaning up the language based on my experience with Ledge Council. So you'll see in subsection 1, the first change, it goes from enacts or enforces to enacts and adopts. Throughout, I put enacts and adopts because local governments enact, state agencies adopt. And in this, with Measure 37, we're talking about state agency rules as well as local ordinance. So you'll see that enacts or adopts language throughout. The effective date of this, sometimes it said the effective date of this amendment. Sometimes it says the effective date of this act. I just plugged in the date, the effective date, December 2nd, 2004. Further down now in subsection, so I don't think that there are any substantive changes in sub 1, sub 2, some clarifying language, substituting this section for this act references, that's done throughout. The first substantive change that I think there's general consensus on, although I'm not clear where to put it, you'll see in 3C, I added, this is the exemption, local regulations required to comply with federal law are exempt from Measure 37, and people have said, raised the question, well, what does that mean for FEMA floodplain insurance regulations? You have to comply with the federal regulations, but it's to get the FEMA insurance, but getting the insurance is optional, so this is neither fish nor fowl. What do we do with that? I think most people I talked to said we don't want to preclude ordinances and regulations designed to make us eligible for FEMA floodplain regulations, and since that's a federal regulation, I put it here under C. It's been argued that it's really a health and safety thing, so it should go under B. To me, it's a distinction without a difference. There might be some slight narrowing or widening of its applicability, whether it's in B or C, but this language is designed to ensure continuing eligibility for FEMA floodplain insurance. Sub 4, the enacted or adopted language, section reference, same in 5. You'll see in, I believe it's here in sub 5, there is a distinction made between claims arising within 2 years after the effective date of this act, and that would just, of Measure 37, and that would just be because you were in 2 years of the effective date of the adoption, of when it was adopted by the people. But the it further went on to state you have a claim also can arise if regulation is enforced within 2 years after a public entity applies the land use regulation as an approval criteria. So you could be 5-10 years after the adoption of Measure 37, but if there's a regulation applied, then you've got a 2-year window to file your Measure 37 claim. So there's a really two different time frames, and I tried to make it clear in the language of sub 5 when we're talking about one versus the other. Also, there is, well, the same provision or the same kind of analysis applies to regulations adopted after the effective date of Measure 37. And that's that last sentence there in sub 5 for claims arising after the regulations enacted after December 2nd and so on. So at any rate, the revisions there try to clarify the timing. Sub 6 is entirely new and addresses the claims, what it takes to constitute a legitimate claim. And I try to be very, very basic, very rudimentary here. The lead-in sentence does allow the public entity to establish additional criteria if it wishes, and you see that here in the including but not limited to lead-in in sub 6. That's something you want to think about. But the minimal sorts of things that I thought would be necessary to do any Measure 37 claim, A, the name of the property owner submitting the claim and the nature of their interest, I own this or I own it with my sister or whatever. It's been suggested that we ought to add the address and tax lot number of the property. There's at least one claim I'm aware of. The claimant doesn't want to tell anybody what the property is. How you process that claim, I have no idea, and you don't even know what property you're talking about. It seems to me that knowing what property you're talking about would be useful. Evidence of ownership or other interest in property, it's not just enough to say, I own that property over there. Here's the description of it. You also have to come forward with a deed or some other evidence that you actually do have an ownership interest in the property. This is where I tried to get at something that folks have been talking about. Under the current measure, it's theoretically possible that you could go back now and repurchase Grandpa's homestead, even though it's been owned by other people in the intervening period. You could go back and repurchase that and say, my family purchased this property in 1901, therefore my claim relates back to 1901. And talking to folks, it seemed to be nobody's intent that you could to allow that scenario, that the relating back to the time the family purchased the property had to be in a direct chain of title. In other words, it's been in your family the entire time since they bought it. So that's C. If your demand is based on family ownership, come forward with some evidence that the property has been, in fact, owned by the family since that time. D, list or description, identify which regulations you claim reduce the property value. And then some evidence, and I expressly avoided the word appraisal here, but some evidence that supports the amount that you're claiming the fair market value has been reduced. That can be assessor's records, that could be an appraisal, it could be any number of things. Letters from realtors. That I use the word evidence to leave it open. Seven adds some things that are not currently in Measure 37, but again, I think most of these have general consensus, but I could be mistaken. First sentence in sub 7, a demand for compensation must be signed or included the written consent of all the owners of the real property. And this is to try to avoid a situation where if three or four people own property commonly, each one comes forward with their own claim. I mean, what are you supposed to do with that? The next sentence, an owner can only file one demand per property for all the regulations in effect at the time it was submitted. If you want to file your claim with Marion County for their regulations that devalue your property, you have to come forward with your one claim at this with a single claim, and don't keep coming back with little claims. Now I'm going to $10,000 for this regulation, $15,000 for this regulation, $30,000 for that regulation. This one suggestion for an additional sentence here was pointed out to me. This sentence seems to suggest that you only get one demand or one claim, when in fact there would be two if the local regulation is pursuant to a state regulation. You would file one claim with the local government and one claim with the state agency. So it's been suggested to add a second another sentence here that the owner may file a claim with each jurisdiction that enacted or adopted regulations, and I think that's a good suggestion. And then give the public entity kind of general authority to adopt a fee for reviewing and processing the claim, but only in an amount sufficient to cover the cost of reviewing the claim. That's a provision that I put in hundreds of statutes over the years. Seemed reasonable here, but that's open for discussion, I'm sure. In subsection 8, moving on to the next page here, I broke this down. This deals with when you want to, if you don't get the answer you want, and you want to go to court. So 8A retains the existing language. If you believe the regulation continues to apply to your property after more than 180 days after your claim, you can go to circuit court. If you prevail in incurring collecting compensation, you're entitled to reasonable attorney's fees, costs, and so on. The paragraph B tries to flesh this out. One of the problems is the claim may be you may not get the answer you want from a state agency, and state agency orders are subject to the Administrative Procedures Act in Oregon. If there's a written decision from a state agency, there's likely to be a record. If there's a record, it's probably a contested case, and you would go directly to the Court of Appeals. If there's no record, then it's other than a contested case, you would go to the circuit court. If you don't get the answer you like, or if there's no action from the local government, Measure 37 says you go directly to the circuit court. So that's the general structure here in B and C. B has an additional nuance, this business about if there's a written decision, there's a record, and so that would proceed to circuit court as a writ of review. That's an existing cause of action that is based on the record that was developed at before the local government. If there's nothing, if the local government simply fails to act, and on 181st day you want to go to circuit court, there's no record, so you would proceed in a manner provided for a declaratory judgment elsewhere in ORS Chapter 28, and the record would be developed then at circuit court. I'll be honest, this is we're doing the best we can, but that's an ad hoc kind of creation. It seems to be best suited to the circumstances, but I'm certainly open to discussion on this. I rewrote that first sentence there in sub 9. Again, may adopt or enact procedures, but again, I didn't change that part of the sentence that said, in no event shall these procedures act as a prerequisite to filing a compensation claim. There is that business we talked about earlier on the timing about how you can file a claim more than 2 years after regulation's been enacted, and that occurs when you file, for example, a land use application and a regulation is applied as an approval criteria and it reduces the value of your property. You get a Measure 37 claim, but that scenario is predicated upon you filing a land use application in the first instance. So I added a lead-in sentence here in the middle of the new sub 9 that tries to accommodate that scenario, but then otherwise doesn't change the requirement that not following a local process doesn't preclude you from going into circuit court or to allow the circuit court to delay. So, again, that's another nuance to try to accommodate a portion of Measure 37 that currently seems to contemplate a land use application as a condition precedent to filing a claim in circuit court. The most significant change in there's two significant changes in sub 10. That at the end of 10A, they're adding the sentence that public entity may modify, remove, or not apply only those land use regulations that it adopted. I'll be frank, there's a fork in the road. There is some discussion about trying to set up a system that would allow a landowner to file only a single claim addressing all regulations that apply to the property, local ordinances, state agency rules, state statutes, and have a single decision. That requires either the state to be able to waive local ordinances or local governments to waive state laws and rules. Both of those were problematic for a number of reasons. The current practice now, even in Dorothy English's case, is to file in both at both levels, one claim with the local government, one claim with the state agency. This sentence maintains that process, and which is cleaner, but it does require two demands for compensation as opposed to one. 10B.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
On that point, could it be even more claims than that, like if you had a city and a county and a state and maybe a regional government? I mean, you could have potentially four claims, couldn't you?
I can envision a scenario where you would have overlapping city and county. In my personal, although there might be examples around the state, my personal knowledge is when cities and counties tend to transfer jurisdiction between each other. It's a little unclear in the case of annexation. If city moves out and annexes territory, but they haven't adopted new land use regulations for that territory yet, and so the old rules continue to apply until new rules are developed to apply to that territory. But this sentence says only the public entity that adopted the rules can repeal them. So in that scenario, the annexed territory would continue to be subject to county rules until the city adopts new rules for that area, and so the claim would have to be filed with the county. Now, the nuance there is that Metro is probably different because of their functional plan. Their functional plan is subordinate to state statutes, and then the local comprehensive plans are subordinate to the functional plan. So there could be three levels of claims in the Metro area. Elsewhere in the state, it shouldn't be more than two.
Thank you for that clarification.
10B reflects some restructuring I did. I moved this sentence down here that says that a decision to pay compensation or to waive the rules is not a land use decision. And somebody said, well, does that mean a land use decision and a limited land use decision? And instead of starting to list out all the things it's not, I think the best suggestion I've heard is to say the decision of a local government to pay compensation or to waive under Measure 37 is not subject to review by LUBA. So it's subject to the review provisions that are set out at the top of the page.
Well, Mr. Chair, would that then affect, say, if you had one landowner next to another and landowner A has a Measure 37 claim that lets them put a pig fat rendering plant on their property, and landowner B says that's a land use decision that adversely affects my property value, therefore I'm going to file a Measure 37 claim. Does this affect the rights of landowner B to have any say?
No, under current law, it would not. This just affects where you would appeal the local government's decision on the Measure 37 claim itself. if for either as the neighbor or as the claimant, if you didn't like the decision that the local government or the state agency handed down, the question is, where do you appeal it? Do you go to Luber or do you go to circuit court? If it's state agency, do you go to Luber, circuit court, or the Court of Appeals? This gets at that question, but it doesn't affect the rights of the Measure 37 claimant or of a neighbor to seek review of the decision.
So this would throw it into circuit court?
If it is a local government decision or a state agency decision made without a record.
Okay. Thank you.
11 is another piece that is probably more controversial than a lot of the rest of it. The new sub 11 creates says that a public entity that makes a decision on Measure 37 claim has to have at least one public hearing on the claim before making payment or waiving, and that it would have to provide individualized written notice to property owners. Here I put in within 750 feet, and somebody pointed out to me that that could be a problem in cities. 750 feet of a subject property in cities could be a lot of folks. There is another statute, RS-197-763, that sets out kind of a differential analysis for with different distances. I think it's 100 feet in a city, 250 feet outside the city but within a UGB, and 500 feet outside of a UGB. So I would bring in that statutory reference for who has to get notice. There has been some in moving on to subsection 12. If I remember correctly, is clarifying until you get onto the next page. This is now page 4, the top of page 4, that bold-faced language. There's been confusion about that last sentence in the existing paragraph there. If a claim has not been paid within 2 years of the date on which it accrues, the owner shall be allowed to use the property as permitted at the time the owner acquired the property. What does accrues mean in that sentence? Nobody's been really clear on that, and so I added this sentence that says, for purposes of this subsection, a claim accrues on the date, this says the local government, I need to change that to public entity, so it could be a state agency. So the claim accrues on the date the public entity issues a written decision on a claim, or a court enters final judgment in favor of compensation, and all appeals are final. So if you... Okay, it's an or there. So your claim accrues on the date the local government issues a decision, or if there's no decision and you take them to court on the 181st day, it accrues on the date you get a judgment in your favor. And the rest of the... in the definitions, I changed that to LC form and style. And there is a statutory severability clause in Oregon in ORS Chapter 174, so this sub 13 is superfluous. So, in the interest of clarity, I took it out. That's one benefit to a statutory. Something adopted as a statutory adoption rather than constitutional, is we can go in and clean up the language. So, that's what. Deleting 13 is. Oh, and then the other thing that I would suggest adding to this is something that clarifies that any changes should be applied to claims filed on or after the effective date of whatever bill this is that adopts the cleanup language, so that people who have adopted their claims now relying on the existing language may continue to rely on that language. That's it, and I'm curious to hear what everybody else has to say.
Chair?
Yes.
Would someone who has already filed a claim under the existing language be able to refile the claim under this? There's nothing to prevent that?
No, I don't believe there's anything to prevent that. You could file a letter with the local government saying, you know, I hereby withdraw the claim I filed December 15th, and then 2 weeks later submit something under the new language. Sure.
Okay, thank you.
I have a number of other questions. I guess first I'd like to hear from Director Shetterly, who's been sitting there so patiently, listening about guest ranches, baked beans for dinner after buck and hay all day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have your letter. I'm pleased to be able to actually hear this. I just received this when it was distributed out in the room, so my opportunity to respond has been limited to the time that it's taken Mr. Crane to go through it. I would agree that he's identified several of the recurrent issues that we have heard at the programs that he and I both have attended on ballot measure 37. I think this does a good job of beginning to respond to those. I think I will defer making any comments on this until I've had a chance to spend some more time with this. And I would actually be enlightened to hear some of the comments on the committee about the direction you intend to go with this. And, Mr. Chair, to the extent that this becomes part of the Wednesday morning meetings that you'll be talking about, I'll be pleased to participate in those discussions as well. Like I say, my time with this has been about 10 minutes now, so I think I'll exercise an element of discretion and wait until I've had a chance to further digest this and maybe hear some of the further conversation that'll help me get my hands better around about what this proposes. But I sure do recognize the issues that Mr. Crane has identified in this as being common, not only in the programs that we've attended on this, but also the House Land Use Committee has been conducting hearings on ballot measure 37, and these are consistent with some of the questions that have been coming not only from state but also from local governments and others who have been looking at the measure as well.
Thank you. One of the issues flagged by Mr. Crane was whether we have a local entity can waive a state regulation and vice versa. Do you have a position as to the most workable way to address that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's, again, going to be subject for some discussion. I think I tend to agree that the cleanest method reserves the waiver authority to the entity that has enacted the policy that's reflected in the particular rule. That way, and it works both ways. We don't have state making decisions on local ordinances and local government making decisions on state rules or statutes. That is consistent with what has been recommended as the best practices under ballot measure 37, where the measure is not entirely clear who has that waiver authority. It has been consistently recommended as best practice that until there is some clarification forthcoming either from the legislature or from some judicial determination and interpretation, that property owners are best served by filing in both places. And I think that's consistent with the advice the proponents have offered as well. So I think this captures what has been emerged as consensus advice on how best to proceed. But I will point out, without answering the question, I think this still leaves open the question who has authority to waive a state statute.
Right. Okay. This currently the state is not requiring any application fee. A lot of the local jurisdictions are. State's not, because it doesn't have authority from DAS to collect that money. Do you think it makes sense to ask for a reasonable fee?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess in terms of at the state level, there certainly is cost associated with evaluating claims. We're finding substantial research in many cases on ownership issues as well as regulations. I think Mr. Crane mentioned at least one claim where the claimant has declined to identify the property. We've got claims in where they're declining to identify what use they intend to put the property to. That involves staff time, give and take, trying to tease out the information on which then to make it a decision. So there certainly is cost associated with this. I guess it comes from one of two sources, and I think that's a legislative determination, either from filing fee to defray some of those costs, sufficient but yet not so much as to act as a barrier to claims, or it'll be a matter of identifying in the budget the resources for agencies that are evaluating these claims to manage that. It's going to come from one place or the other.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would point out that I did draft this in the last sentence in subsection 7. Because the definition of public entity includes the state, where we say a public entity may impose a fee for reviewing the demand for compensation, that would extend to state agencies. And it was my intent in drafting this, at least, to make it express, to give express authority to agencies to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Committee, any questions? Okay. All right. Thank you very much for joining us. Why don't we have Elon Hassan and Randy Tucker, please? I think Randy ducked out, so Elon, you're on your own.
Thank you, Chair Ringo. Randy Tucker said that he was had another meeting to go to and apologizes. My name is Elon Hassan. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends. We have seen a testimony, which is being handed out now, from Bob Stacey, and I've also attached a report on an economics from an economist at Oregon State University regarding compensation. 1,000 Friends of Oregon supports these proposed amendments that are before the committee. We believe it's the right approach to the claims processing aspect for three reasons. First, it gets at informing governments of the claims involved. It provides for notice to neighbors affected and provides for the opportunity for a hearing. And while we think this is a great start, we don't. It's a good beginning, but it's not sufficient to allow fairness for all those affected by Measure 37. We encourage the committee to continue to pursue some of those other the other components which would make that a reality, which would be elimination of the waivers under Measure 37. Our land use laws protect property value as well as managed development. When those laws are waived, neighboring property owners are hurt, and two wrongs don't make a right, and we'd like to see the fairness put back into land use planning. Also, evaluation of claims. We encourage the committee to adopt a program where the loss is measured at the time the loss occurs, and that's some of what's talked about in this 15-page paper, which is before you. And the third thing we want to do is we'd like to see happen is funding property owners, payments, a funding mechanism for that. We support Section 18 of Senate Bill 406, which is the transfer development credit. We don't support the property tax portion of Senate Bill 406. We don't think we should be creating new taxes to fund this. Finally, the payment that property owners receive, we should get something in return for that, an easement, a restriction on title to make sure that there's that the public is getting something for what they purchase. So we encourage the committee to approve the procedural reforms in this bill, but not pass it out of committee today, but rather to hold on to it and pass it out as part of a larger package. That's all I have.
Thank you. Well, at this point, it's not even a bill.
Yep.
Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much, Elon. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to comment on this? Well, we'll close the hearing in a minute then, but I wanted to say that on the Wednesday morning hearing, we're going to follow up on the claims process, but also we've got what Chris Crane has drafted for a compensation mechanism. And Kate, if you could put that out. Is that what you're putting out right now? Yeah, she's nodding her head. And so that will also hopefully serve as a basis of discussion for our Wednesday morning meeting to start moving forward on compensation mechanisms. So feel free to grab one of those, and if you want to get more of those, we can make them available. Anything from the committee then? Any comments from the gallery out there? Okay, well then we're adjourning Senate Environment and Land Use Committee. Thank you.